This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Our first question comes by email from Scott McKee. He asks, if you have telescopes that can see other galaxies millions and millions of miles away, then with the Moon being so close, can't you get brilliant close-up pictures of the Moon?
Actually, no, we can't. And before I explain the reasons why, we need to know a little bit about angles. Now, us astronomers work with very small angles when measuring the size of things in the sky. We take a degree and we split it up into 60 arc minutes, and then split an arc minute into 60 arc seconds. The Moon's about half a degree across, so it's about 1800 arc seconds. And at the distance of the Moon, each arc second works out to be about a kilometre across. So how small an object can we see with a telescope? Firstly, we're limited by the Earth's atmosphere. Now, the movement of the air in the atmosphere distorts the light that we receive from space, and this is what caused the stars to twinkle in the first place. And it can be a real pain for astronomers because it makes all our pictures a bit blurry. Even from the best sites on Earth, we're limited to about half an arc second, or about 500 metres across from the Moon. We can get around this by fancy electronics and so forth, but even the best telescopes we can use only see things that are about a tenth of an arc second across, or 100 metres, on the Moon. Now, that's 100 metres from the best telescopes that we have. Now, if you want to have some context for that, the Apollo orbiters captured images at about 30 metres resolution. And earlier this year, the Chinese lunar orbiter Chang'e 2 returned images at about 7 metres resolution. So it turns out it's just a lot better to send a spacecraft to the Moon to map it. So what do we get from big telescopes if it's not just to see small details? Well, it's not all about the resolution, although the high resolutions that we do have mean that we can detect some pretty fantastic things. But what a big telescope really means is more light. Some of the faintest things that we look at are over a billion times fainter than you can see with your eyes. So, while we'd like a telescope a few billion times bigger than the human eye, we've got to settle with the biggest ones that we've got today, which are a few million times as big. So even with these big telescopes, our real limitation is just the fact that we're trying to peer into the darkness to see faint fuzzy blobs.
So sometimes it's not all about the spatial resolution or the smallest thing that you can see then?
Not always, but it does help sometimes.
The next question is another email from Les French, who says, as I was looking at the night sky, a dim star suddenly became extremely bright and then suddenly disappeared, a bit like a light bulb blowing. Could you please give me some further information?
Now, nearly everyone has a story about something in the night sky they couldn't explain, even I do. But one of the conversations astronomers frequently have at those kind of parties is inevitably something similar to this. Almost every time, no one remembers enough information for us to answer it. Now, Les, on the other hand, has included a lot of information about what he saw, including the direction, altitude, and time. Even then, there's several possibilities. However, most times you see something like this in the sky, they turn out to be either a satellite, or a meteor, or an aeroplane. Now, you may laugh that someone doesn't recognise an aeroplane, but when it's dark, and it's close to the horizon, and heading towards you, it's not always easy. I've got the unfortunate situation of living at the end of the landing path from Manchester Airport. Often the only way I can tell something's a plane is when it turns to land, and it starts to get dimmer, and starts flashing its landing lights. More commonly, however, something unexplained like this might be a meteor. Most meteors are just momentary flashes of light, but some can be big enough to last for several seconds. They often produce bursts of light as they fragment, and this can produce very vivid colours as they charge the surrounding atmosphere. Now, these typically move across the sky very fast, unless, of course, they're heading towards you. These can often be tied to various meteor showers, but the biggest ones are sporadic and can happen at any time. So if you see something that's bright and changes suddenly, and is very colourful, then this can often be a meteor. But quite often man-made satellites can also spook people. Satellites come in all shapes and sizes and can do some very funny things. Generally, they track slowly across the sky, brightening and fading as they go. Some satellites, like the Iridium satellites, can catch the sun at just the right angle, and they can outshine any planet or star in the sky for a second or two. There's something quite special about that when you're not expecting it. Satellites can be easily tracked using a variety of publicly available tools, which we'll try and put on the website for you. But we can't help Les here because we need to know where he lives. And of course, there's everything else. Just about anything can look funny in the dark, especially if it changes and you're not looking at it directly to begin with. And this can be a particular problem if it's cloudy too and things disappear and reappear from behind clouds. So if you ever find yourself in this kind of situation, write down as much information as you can. Where were you? What were you doing? Where in the sky was it, especially compared to particular stars you know of? What it looked like, and what it did? Now send that information to your local friendly astronomer, and he'll promptly tell you that they have no idea what it was you saw. Whatever it is, though, there's probably a million and one explanations you can invoke before considering little green men. So I'm sorry, Les, but we've no idea what it was you saw.
This does sound quite familiar, actually.
Yes.
Sometimes you see things, and the thing is, you can't really tell how far away they are or how high they are necessarily, because it could be a bright thing far away or a nearby thing that's not so bright.
Yeah, I mean, there's people who come back and say, oh, it was the size of an aeroplane, but that really depends on how far away it was.
So there we go. Unidentified flying objects might be a little more mundane than we thought. The third question is another email from Pat O'Grady, and it's about exoplanets. For exoplanets, the search is to find stars with planets. But why not start from the other way around? Why is a star without planets not the exception rather than the rule?
Well, quite simply, when we look for planets, it's a lot easier to find a planet that is there than rule out an infinite number of possible planets that could exist. For almost every star, proving there isn't a planet going around it is currently impossible. So the truth of the matter is that we don't really know whether having planets is normal for a star or not. We also don't really know how many planets is a typical number for a star. We don't even know what a typical planet looks like. But we're getting closer to finding out, thanks to a number of projects, particularly the Kepler space mission. From these projects, for example, we know that about 10% of stars have a hot gas giant orbiting very close to them. We also know that small planets, like the Earth, are more common than big ones, like Jupiter. And from these observations, we can estimate that about 40% of stars have planets. But that's really only based on the giant planets, like Jupiter and Saturn. We only really know of a handful of rocky planets like the Earth, because they're really difficult to detect. We simply don't know how many planets there are. The current estimates suggest that most stars indeed do have one planet about the size of the Earth. So watch this space. Seems like planetless stars are indeed the exceptions. And there's many ways that stars can lose planets, so understanding why some stars have planets and some don't will ultimately tell us a lot about how stars formed interact with each other.
It's really just an emerging field, isn't it, detecting planets around stars? That's the thing. It's quite difficult to do, and, well, if you go back about 20 years, it just wasn't even possible.
Certainly, and 20 years ago we didn't even know that there were planets outside our solar system at all. And certainly in the last few years, we've gone from having a handful of planets to having nearly 1,000 now.
And the last question comes from Twitter. Susan Kelly says, would a star 5 times more massive than our Sun exert the same gravity as a much more compact neutron star of the same mass?
First of all, a very minor technicality here. We can't get a neutron star that's 5 times the mass of the Sun, be so dense that we collapse into a black hole. The most massive one we know of is about 2 times the mass of the Sun. So we'll rephrase the question. Would a 2-solar mass star exert the same gravity as a 2-solar mass neutron star? The answer is yes, it would. Any two objects of the same mass will have the same gravity. But we need to be a little careful about what we mean when we say gravity here. What we're talking about is the amount an object will pull on another object. So the Earth doesn't care if it's orbiting the Sun, orbiting a neutron star of the same mass. It will orbit just the same. You might care, of course, if the Sun suddenly turned a neutron star, but at least we'd be able to test some really cool physics before we died a horrible, horrible death. Now, what the smaller radius of the neutron star does mean, however, is it's got a much higher surface gravity than a star of the same mass. And if you're able to stand on the surface of these two objects, and I really wouldn't recommend it, then you'd experience gravity very differently. For example, if you were to stand on the typical 2-solar mass star, you'd experience gravity that was about 30 times the gravity on Earth. However, since the star doesn't have a solid surface, you'd just plunge to a rather different, fiery, unpleasant death. Now, if you were able to stand a 2-solar mass neutron star, you'd briefly experience something a little different. Now, unlike normal stars, neutron stars do have a solid surface. While a typical 2-solar mass star would be over 500,000 miles across, a 2-solar mass neutron star might only be 20 miles across, or even less. And this gives us a phenomenally powerful surface gravity, nearly 1 trillion times that of the Earth. If you were able to stand one, you'd instantly get made into atomic pancake on the surface. So in short, two objects of the same mass will always have the same gravity. However, if one's a lot denser, then it allows other objects on the surface of them to experience gravity up close. Oh, and the universe is a really nasty place filled with 1 million interesting different ways to die.
This always puts me in mind of black holes a bit, because sometimes people say, well, don't black holes just suck everything in? And I sort of say, well, if you're far enough away from them, then no. But you can get close to them because they're so compact. And if you do get really close, that's when you're in trouble.
Yes, it's actually really difficult to get that close to a black hole unless you actually get aimed directly for it.
Thank you very much for all the questions. And if you want to get in touch with any more questions, then you can do so via the usual channels, email, forum, Twitter, Facebook, or good old snail mail.